Michael Cohen appears to be selling access to the President of the United States. We now have multiple different things, supposedly, that Michael Cohen was doing for all these companies. Now we hear from Novartis that he was hired on healthcare matters. Evidently, he's a doctor. One of the companies mentioned they hired him for real estate matters. He's a real estate agent. Another company stated that they hired him for accounting advice. Evidently, he's an accountant. So he's a lawyer, a doctor, an accountant, and a real estate agent. I'm just a lawyer. I'm not bright, I guess.
Stormy Daniels' attorney, Michael Avenatti, doing his thing today on Morning Joe. He's been on TV a lot since he published his report on the president's fixer, Michael Cohen, last night. That damaging executive summary, as it's called, shows that many global companies have paid into a fund Cohen set up right before the election. That fund is called Essential Consultants. Initially, Essential Consultants was set up to pay Stormy Daniels that $130,000 in hush money. But since then, it's received a lot more. More than $4 million between October 2016 and January of this year. Some who paid, AT&T, Novartis, and Korea Aerospace Industries, also a company called Columbus Nova. It paid Cohen's company around $500,000. Columbus is associated with a Russian oligarch who was recently sanctioned by the United States. To help us understand more, I'm joined now by Jed Legum. He's the editor-in-chief of Think Progress, and that's part of the left-leaning think tank Center for American Progress. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's start with the oligarch. His name is Viktor Vekselberg. Tell us more about him and how he might be involved with Columbus Nova.
Well, he is the owner of a very large holding company in Russia called Renova, and has really far-flung investments. There is essentially a U.S. company that is closely associated with him called Columbus Nova. That was the company that paid these monies to Michael Cohen.
Now, Columbus says it's not associated.
They say that they're its largest client, that Renova is its largest client, but that they're a separate company owned by Americans. And some of that is technically true, but as of January 2017, if you went to the Renova website, it listed Columbus Novo as a subsidiary of the Renova Group in Russia. And the American citizen who is the CEO of Columbus Novo is the oligarch's cousin. So it is set up separately, but it seems far from certain that it actually operates as a separate entity.
So what is your understanding as to what Columbus Nova is and does?
They are I think it's the vehicle in which the Renova Group invests in United States properties. Now, they claim they handle investments for other clients. We don't know who those clients are, but they make a lot of different, you know, media investments, technological investments. And I guess they're saying that, according to the company, that they contacted Cohen in order to get his advice about investments. But, you know, $500,000 is a lot of money for investment advice.
Especially since they say they're in the business of giving investment advice.
Yes. Yeah, they're experts in investing.
So why would they ask him for advice?
I don't know. I don't know why, and I think that's the problem. And I think with Columbus Novo, but also the other companies, Novartis actually came out and said, well, you know, we signed this contract. It was actually for $1 million with Michael Cohen. And we met with him once in March 2017 and determined that he couldn't actually help us with anything, but we paid him anyway.
So he received more than $1 million from Novartis, this pharmaceutical company, for one meeting.
And in that meeting, all he was able to do is communicate to them, or at least that's what they took away from it, that he couldn't help them at all. So even that meeting, according to the company itself, was of little use to them, which makes sense because if you understand Essential Consulting and how we came to know about it, it is not a real company. It is a shell company that was set up to pay this $130,000 fee to Stormy Daniels. It doesn't have a website. It doesn't have any public-facing presence. It doesn't have any employees that we know of. So the idea that it was set up to provide these very sophisticated consulting companies to multinational corporations is just pretty far-fetched.
The other big company involved here is AT&T, which is currently trying to merge with Time Warner and get regulatory approval for that. They paid Cohen $200,000.
At least $200,000. I think that that Avenatti probably had a partial understanding of what the payments were, and it looks like that was $50,000 a month for an entire year for Michael Cohen from AT&T. And of course, you know, this came as AT&T was pursuing a big merger with Time Warner, $83 billion merger. And again, you know, what did Michael Cohen do? Was this really for a service that he provided, or was this a way to buy access? Was this a pay to play arrangement? And you know, I think there's a lot of questions about that haven't even begun to be answered.
And what has AT&T said about it?
AT&T has said that they made this arrangement to get insight into the new administration, but there was no lobbying or legal services provided. So I think the question becomes, if there is no lobbying, if Michael Cohen wasn't using his connections with Trump or other people in the administration to help AT&T for this money, you know, what was he doing? What kind of insights did he really have that would be worth several hundred thousand dollars?
And so what illegality could possibly be raised here?
Well, I think that there's a couple of things. I mean, I think for Cohen himself, there could be a number of issues around bank fraud. How this came out was a suspicious activities report that gets filed by banks from the Justice Department when they start to see things that don't look right. And part of what we know from that report, which is really the basis of the Avenatti document that he released.
He hasn't said that, but that's what your assumption is?
I'm speculating on that because it's the same kind of information. Uh-huh. You know, and part of the information that they provide as part of those reports is you have to tell the bank, what is this company that you're setting up a bank account for? What does it do? And he said it was for real estate consulting. And so, you know, that's part of the problem that Cohen might find, is that it looks like he was doing a lot of different things with this shell company, including paying off women who claim to have had affairs with the president. But, you know, that's not what he said as part of these documents and setting up the account. So that could be bank fraud. I think that if it was proven that, you know, this was a way not just to buy some kind of service from Cohen, but to provide money that would be used to directly benefit the president. Or if the president himself was directing these monies to Cohen, that could be a much broader corruption scandal that would encompass, you know, for bribery, effectively, that would encompass, you know, Cohen and the president. And in the absence of any credible explanation of what the money is for, I think that's why those questions are still lingering.
All right. The story continues. Judd, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
That's Judd Legum. He's editor-in-chief of Think Progress, which is part of the Center for American Progress. Coming up, who won last night's debate between California's gubernatorial candidates? We'll tell you next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're less than a month away from California's June primary, when voters will decide which two candidates will face off in November to be the next governor. The top six hopefuls participated last night in what's likely to be the final major debate before the election. Four Democrats and two Republicans took the stage in San Jose. They fielded questions on the state's housing problem, the sanctuary law, even a couple of the candidates' extramarital affairs. Well, here to help us recap the debate is Ben Adler. He's the Capitol Bureau chief for Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Hey there.
Hey, how are you, Madeline?
Great, thanks. Okay, well, let's start with the front runner in the race, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. He came under a lot of fire from pretty much everyone last night. Here's a clip from the debate where State Treasurer John Chung attacked him and former L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa over the state's homelessness crisis.
Gavin's talking about what he'll do in the future. I'm doing it today. As the state treasurer, in my first year in office, I brought together housing leaders. And by my second year, I increased financing for new and rehabilitated housing by over 80%, including special needs categories, which involve the homeless. I'm the one who brought together a coalition that's putting together a bond that I want to encourage California voters to vote for. I want to bring back redevelopment agencies. But I think it's important we don't do what Gavin and Antonio did in regards to criminalizing the homelessness.
Okay. So first of all, how did they respond? Did they respond much differently to that question of how to provide more housing and how to end homelessness?
Well, they both pointed to their records in San Francisco saying, look, we've taken this on. We've tried to do it. But they've also made big promises about how many units to build that I think independent analysts have said it would be hard to really do quite that much of. I think I saw 3.5 million units is what they're saying. And that's experts say really hard to do.
That's what Newsom and Villaraigosa are
yeah,
saying.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Now, what was noteworthy there is John Chung was one of the most aggressive candidates throughout the night. And he was really the only Democratic candidate who was out there regularly criticizing other Democrats. There were Republicans lobbing bombs at Newsom Newsom lobbing bombs back at the Republicans. But Newsom didn't respond to Chung. And, Villaraigosa tried to float above the fray and not get involved in any of that stuff. It just reflects the different positions that everyone's in, right? Chung is down in the polls and needs to make a comeback and show some contrast. Newsom's the front runner, and he wants to elevate the Republicans by criticizing them and build them up so Republicans vote for one of them and so he can face a Republican in November instead of another Democrat. That's his goal.
Right, because then he'd easily trounce the Republican given the state's demographics at this point.
Your words, not mine.
Well, that's what he thinks, at least.
Yes.
Okay. So also Delaine Easton, she is the other Democrat in the race. And how did she do?
She actually, I thought, made an impact that's disproportionate to where she stands in the polls, which is down near the bottom. Her positions are unabashedly progressive, and she's been hoping to channel Bernie Sanders and that kind of activism into a strong showing. But she hasn't been able to raise a lot of money, and a lot of the big progressive endorsements, like unions, for example, have gone not to her but to Gavin Newsom, even though she is probably more progressive, more liberal consistently than Gavin Newsom is. But I think a lot of the groups are saying, look, Gavin's got a better shot at winning, so we're going to go with him instead. But Easton, and if you have some tape, you now'd be the time to play it. She had a bunch of one-line zingers throughout the night and got some big applause lines. And I thought she stood out much more than Antonio Villaraigosa, who, even though he is fighting for second place, again, he really just tried to blend in almost. And I didn't notice him stand out the way Delaine Easton did.
Okay, so I do think we have a clip of tape of her. It is, I think she said she was asked about character and whether that matters in the race. Here she is.
At the end of the day, it is inappropriate for any boss in any business or any government agency to make passes at women that work for them. And when that happens, it ought to be given a shout out.
Okay, and then that escalated to this exchange between Republican Travis Allen and Newsom.
The question is very simple, ladies and gentlemen. If you can't trust Gavin with his best friend's wife, how can you trust him with your state?
Mr. Newsom, I'll give you 30 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard with respect to hear from Mr. Allen, who's a devout supporter of Donald Trump, talk about the issue of sexual harassment. And as it relates to the issue that's been referred to, I was honest about it. I was open about it.
Okay, so how did he handle that, do you think?
That's a lot to unpack. It did start with Delaine Easton being asked about character. And we should let listeners know that there are a few different incidents being referred to. There is Gavin Newsom, who as mayor of San Francisco, had an affair with his best friend's wife, who, more relevant to the discussion in the Me Too era, reported to him, worked at the city. And then when she left, she received some $10,000. And I guess it was, I don't know if settlement's the right word, but it was health pay or you know, recovery of some sort. And so that has gotten some criticism, even though the woman has come out and said, look, I don't think this was, you know, I believe in Me Too, but I don't think this was a Me Too moment back then. Antonia Villaraigosa had an affair with a reporter, a TV journalist, and that, as he acknowledged last night, ruined his marriage. So he and Newsom both had similar messages in taking responsibility. The distinction, of course, is that Newsom's affair was with someone who technically reported to him. That was not the case with Villaraigosa. And then Travis Allen has been accused with all the lawmakers at Sacramento when the Senate and Assembly put out that big document dump several months ago of all of the complaints that have been substantiated against a lawmaker or senior staffer in the last 12 years. Allen was on there. There was, as he said, a brief HR discussion about him inappropriately touching. Allen went to the length of blaming Democrats, saying it's partisan politics. That's not a fair response. Most of the people who were who had documents released against them and investigations substantiated were Democrats. And the incident involving Allen occurred many years before he ran for governor.
OK, well, let's talk about what John Cox and Allen really wanted to talk about last night. And that was the gas tax, repealing the
gas tax. I thought you were going to say each other, taking shots at each other.
Well, this does play into that. So here's a clip where Allen is disputing Cox's claim that he started the repeal of the gas tax effort.
Thank you very much. I'd just like to respond to my angry opponent from Chicago. Let's be very clear. I was the original author of the gas tax repeal. I actually fought Attorney General Javier Becerra in court for 6 months because he was trying to lie to the people of California.
Okay, so they're each trying to claim that they are the ones who initiated this repeal of the gas tax. What's the truth?
The truth is that Travis Allen, I believe, was first, but he didn't have the money and he got hung up in a legal battle. John Cox, who does have money from his own fortune, invested in the gas tax repeal effort, which, by the way, the motivation generally lies with the Republican members of Congress and House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who see this as a key opportunity to help turn out Republican voters in an election cycle where turnout has tended to favor Democrats. The thinking being that all these vulnerable Republican members of Congress, many of them down in your listening area, Madeline, would be at risk if Republicans stay home. And so that's why McCarthy came out and endorsed John Cox for governor the other day, right before the Republican convention last weekend. Cox has some money. He's shown he's not afraid to spend it. And McCarthy thinks that Cox has the best shot at advancing to the November general election. He's worried that if there's no Republican at the top of the ticket, and also, as it seems likely, no Republican in the U.S. Senate race, again, what is there to convince Republicans to come out and vote in November? And that could be a catastrophe down ballot for Republicans.
Interesting. And just to note that repeal hasn't been substantiated or approved yet for the ballot, but it looks like it's got enough signatures.
They've turned in a lot of signatures, and the backers are confident that the signatures will be verified and enough of them verified in time to qualify for the November election.
All right. Ben Adler, Capital Bureau Chief for Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. Thanks so much.
Anytime.
Coming up, L.A. was a big hub for gospel music in the 20th century, way back in the 20th century, and a place for gospel artists to break from tradition.
They would wear their hair in the same type of styles that the Supremes wore, and they were seeking, in my humble opinion, to be an equivalent, a religious equivalent to the musicality of Motown.
L.A.'s gospel history, next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. When you think of gospel music, you might think of the American South. But Los Angeles has had a vibrant gospel scene for more than a century. Since the establishment of the first AME church, LA's first black church, by a former slave back in 1872, through the golden age of gospel to today, LA has been an epicenter of the genre and the site of performances like this one. Amazing. Ooh, I just got chills. That's Aretha Franklin singing Amazing Grace at a Baptist church in South LA. It's the best-selling gospel album of all time and Aretha's best-selling album to this day. A new exhibition at the California African American Museum charts LA's rich gospel history. It's called How Sweet the Sound. Curator Tyree Boyd Pates is here now. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Well, ooh, that just was incredible hearing her sing that.
Never
gets old. Well, let's go back to the beginning with Biddy Mason.
Sure.
She was a former slave, came to the LA area, and ended up being a millionaire.
Absolutely.
And also started the first AME church.
Yes, absolutely.
And that was the beginnings of gospel music here?
The beginnings of the rich religious history, black religious history that Los Angeles would have and so would California. Biddy Mason is just an amazing individual whose life and legacy still is felt in Los Angeles today. And it was such a wonderful opportunity to excavate what she had done for Los Angeles religiously and to show and point to people that the churches that they're walking into today are based off of her framework and her philanthropy. And it's such an honor to present her in this exhibition.
Right. And then so nearby there's the, Azusa Street.
Yes, of course.
Famously. And this evangelist, William Joseph Seymour, spawns this massive Pentecostal movement.
Yes.
And talk about how that dovetails with gospel music.
Oh, absolutely. So it's really cool because down in Little Tokyo is a little street called Azusa. But before the revival hit, it was actually at Monte Bray where William Seymour and his colleagues got the Holy Spirit. Really, like it was a Pentecostal movement that was only supposed to exist for several days and would last for several years. And because of the outgrowth and the excitement and the healings and the miracles, it had to move into a warehouse in Little Tokyo. And the Azusa Street Revival just expanded. But out of that, the Pentecostal movement would spread across the country and eventually the world. And out of that, the Church of God in Christ would come about in 1907 by Bishop Mason, who was so emboldened by the Pentecostal movement that he wanted to have black female musicians accompany him on stage. And therein lies the flowering of gospel music in LA.
One of the big performers, I suppose, if you could say is a performer, is the choir, the St. Paul Church Choir.
Absolutely.
And I just want to play a performance from 1957.
Keep on waiting. Keep on waiting.
Talk about that form of gospel music. It seems very traditional.
Absolutely.
Gospel music. And so talk about the stylings of that and how it influenced later artists.
Absolutely. Well, it's seen traditionally today, but what St. Paul and Victory Baptist and so many other churches were doing were melding the influences of the musicians and the choral directors who were classically trained, but other of them have come from the South as well. And so they were infusing that down South, good old homegrown music with the organ and all of these other faculties. It would be so innovative that these churches would grow in numbers, and so would their choirs, and they would be as wide as 75 people to 100, and their voices would boom, and these churches started traveling to one another, kind of like lightly competing with one another to see which was the best choir in Los Angeles and comparing it to other places across the country. But Los Angeles was starting to stand out, and that innovation would start to carve out some things several decades later.
How did gospel music get out of the church?
Ooh, it was those who decided to be trailblazers, like the Clara Ward singers in particular. I like to call them the supremes of gospel music. Surely, surely, surely. they decided to take off their robes and decide to wear more form-fitting outfits. Not too form-fitting that it would be seen as
sacrilegious
or distracting, but they would wear their hair in the same type of styles that the Supremes wore. Mm-hmm. And they were seeking, in my humble opinion, to be an equivalent, a religious equivalent to the musicality of Motown. And with that, you have these women who decided to bring the sound of the church to the world. And whether they were performing in nightclubs or at Disneyland, heck, they even performed at the Playboy Mansion for Hugh Hefner and the Playboy Bunnies on the Playboy Channel, and they were singing gospel music.
Well, I think that what our party really needs is a little gospel sound. So I wonder if you could get the girls together and maybe give us a little Clara Ward gospel singing.
We'd love to.
It doesn't get any more outside of the church than the Playboy Mansion. Playboy Mansion. And so because of their innovation and really their boldness and courage, they were able to bring it outside of the four walls in ways in which no one in the church had ever thought to do.
Well, we can't talk about gospel without talking about Sam Cooke.
No, of course not.
Right. So he grew up singing with his family gospel group in Chicago. And then he came to L.A. and recorded with his group called the Soul Stirrers. Mm-hmm. Which is just a great name.
Yeah.
And I just want to play a little bit from them.
Minister was preaching, and the crowd standing near, the congregation was singing a tune, and a voice was so loud and clear. You know,
so he was actually a crossover star, right? So he went crossed over from gospel to R&B, mm-hmm. back and forth.
Pop, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And did he pave the way for gospel to enter popular music?
He certainly would be one of the mainstays of crossover appeal. I think what worked to his advantage was how handsome he was. women fawned over him, men fawned over him, wanted to be him. And his voice and his ability to write music would open up avenues that I don't think many people were prepared for coming out of gospel music and onto the pop charts. And with the change is going to come, it would become legendary in and of itself. And the reason why he's included in the exhibition is for two reasons. One is because in 1955, he actually performed at the Shrine Auditorium during this large gospel bash, if you will. But he also would find his demise here in Los Angeles. I feel his life and death is too important not to include in the exhibit, and his life would end up becoming a cautionary tale among the gospel community that if you would leave the will of God, if you will, that somehow you are susceptible to some very bad things. And so for gospel singers after Sam Cooke, his life and death means something depending on how you pivot regarding that line.
Well, is there any division in the gospel world and community in terms of how secular you should be and whether or not you should bring the music out into the larger community?
Absolutely. I think it's this very interesting tug of war between being more liberal and being more conservative,
yeah.
right? And ironically, those who are more of a conservative stance about religiosity would believe that you have to keep it at its root and stay it in the four walls, and those who have more of a liberal view on it want to bring it out into the world and make it more inclusive. And I think this tug of war that the gospel community and the black religious community have is indicative of other tug of wars that they are immersed in. And it kind of underscores how the black music literally is always at the nexus of conversation.
Well, speaking of bringing it out into the larger world, there is Andre Crouch.
Yes.
Called the father of modern gospel music.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually arranged songs for Madonna.
Yeah. And Michael Jackson. And,
oh.
Yeah. His crossover appeal, which is demonstrated within the exhibition, would land him to have his own comic book. He would write his own memoir, his own book, and things of that nature. And I think with Andre Crouch and his ability to traverse both black gospel music and CCM contemporary Christian music, he brought both of those worlds together at a time when both sects of that community needed to come together, and his ability to traverse would only solidify his legend.
No more dying there, no more dying there. Because we're going to see the king. We're coming from every no nation.
So there's now a move to attract younger audiences, right, to gospel.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Maybe audiences who are into hip-hop and sort of crossover. I just want to play Kirk Franklin and God's Property. Let's hear this 1997 song, Stomp.
Glory, glory! Woo! You better put them hands together and act like you know up in here. Cheek peek!
That's just fun. So what's his story, Kirk Franklin?
Kirk Franklin was given his platform because of a Los Angeles-based gospel record label called Gospel Centric Records. And because of him and Gospel Centric's platform, he was able to infuse urban music with gospel music. And because of his pioneering and trailblazing, there would be no Chance the Rapper, whose latest effort is essentially, down to the bare bones, is a gospel music album that has rap on top of it.
The blessings come down. In my lap,
the blessings come down.
When the praises go up, oh, the blessings come down.
Good God!
They booked the nicest hotels on the 59th floor, with the big wide windows, with the suicide doors. Ain't no blood on my money. Ain't no Twitter in heaven. I know them drugs isn't close. Ain't no visit in heaven. I know the difference in blessings and worldly possessions. Like
I am so encouraged and I'm so inspired by Kirk Franklin's boldness, because he would allow the next generation, millennials or whatever you want to call us, to be unapologetic about our faith as we are about the music that comes out of our streets.
Tyree Boyd-Pates, thank you so much for coming in today.
The pleasure was completely mine.
Tyree Boyd-Pates is history curator and program manager at the California African American Museum. He curated the new exhibition up right now. It's called How Sweet the Sound, Gospel Music in Los Angeles, and it's up through August 26th. Coming up, the Sklar brothers are here to talk sports, and they're going to make a few jokes. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
Yes, it says it all. It says it's time to talk sports with our fabulous duo, Randy and Jason Sklar, the Sklar brothers. Hi, you guys.
Hey, hello. So good to be back at this time right now, which is one of the most exciting times in all sports.
I thought you were going to say it was because of our fundraiser.
Oh, in the most exciting times of all.
Well,
the most exciting time in all the sports is the KCRW fundraiser. You didn't know that?
Pledge drive.
There are, like, you know, NBA players will, they won't thank their mom at the end of a game. They'll say, thank you, KCRW, for all that you do.
Well, they should.
They absolutely should. How great would that be if James Harden did that?
You would die. I'd love it.
All right. Hopefully he's listening. All right. So let's talk about LeBron James.
Unbelievable.
He's doing pretty well, right?
Anybody who questioned his greatness, he is putting it on full display. I think he's had more than four games of over 40 points in this playoffs. And he's kind of
two last second game winning shots to win playoff games, to do it on that level. His first one, he shot a long three to beat the Indiana Pacers on a night where he took no 3-point shots. The whole time he was driving to the basket. And so the player who was defending him
kind of laid off him a little bit, and then he hits this shot and wins the game. And then in this last series against Toronto, Toronto was the number one seed in the East. And by the way, the Cavaliers were the fourth seed. They went through a lot of different lineup changes. They'd made a big trade in the middle of the season. They are gelling at the right time. They're going to face a very difficult Boston Celtics team in the next round, I believe.
Which is kind of crazy because Kyrie Irving is not going to be playing.
Kyrie Irving, who played with LeBron James, and actually they won their one championship together. He is now on the Boston Celtics, and he is injured. So they are playing with these young guys, and Boston is all about the system and these young guys getting plugged in. So it's going to be a nice matchup.
But that makes me think of the Warriors too.
Well, the Warriors
have a system.
They definitely have a system.
They have a system, and they have superstars, which is why they're so amazing. They have both of those things combined.
So Steph Curry's back.
Steph Curry's back. He's back from injury. He was out for 5 weeks. He came back in this past series. Not only is he back, but he's making an impact on the game. So Kevin Durant is the other star on the team who takes the team on his shoulders. Don't forget about Klay Thompson and Draymond Green. Draymond Green is averaging a triple-double.
He maybe had the best series.
Well, what's a triple-double?
That means that's three stat categories where he has double digits in the stats.
So points, rebounds, assists, maybe blocks, steals. Now they're playing against Houston, which is the matchup we wanted to see from the beginning. Houston, the number one seed in the West. Chris Paul, former Clipper. For the first time in his career, he gets a chance to make it to the Western Conference Finals. So it's a great thing for Chris Paul. The Houston Rockets are great in that they've got three players that really sort of dominate for them. And perhaps the best player in the league,
James Harden.
Phenomenal beard. I mean, the beard that Hasidic Jews would covet.
Wish they had. Hasidic Jews and hipsters look at that beard.
Brooklyn hipsters.
Would absolutely love the stuff that's in his beard. I have no idea. He is.
Fear the beard?
It's going to be a great series. Like, I'm so excited.
It's kind of the series we all were expecting and hoping to see. We just didn't know how we'd get there. But here we are, Houston, Golden State on the West side.
I would say this, if you're not a basketball fan, but if you want to see basketball being played on the highest level, now is the time to tune into the NBA playoffs, and you will see some of the most amazing, and it may make you a fan. You're going to see some of the most amazing offensive and defensive plays in the history of basketball.
Imagine if the Alvin Ailey dance troupe had a ball that they were throwing around and trying to defeat another dance troupe.
Now you're
that's
talking
NBA basketball.
Now
we're
talking language.
That's strictly, what I'm talking about.
Strictly ballroom up in here.
Okay. Speaking of graceful hockey.
It's, again, what's why I like this time of year is that you've got the hockey playoffs, the NHL playoffs, and you've got the NBA playoffs.
But we're going to talk about the Las Vegas Golden Knights. So we talked
Nobody
about
expected them.
I know. We talked about them in the show a little while ago. Yeah. So this is a brand new team, and now they are in the playoffs.
So the big deal was, could we have a professional sports team in Las Vegas this close to gambling, this close to people who might be able to influence? This is like a big thing. Like, for years they said, we do not want professional athletics.
I mean, because when you had a college team, UNLV, there was some tampering a little
scandal,
bit.
Scandal, tampering issues, but they're close to gambling, and that's always a big thing and a problem for professional sports. But finally, that has been broken down. They said, okay, we're going to have – and ironically, when they started the season – the Golden Knights were about 150-1 odds to win the Stanley Cup. So people in Vegas, gamblers, regular people said, I'll throw $100 on that.
Yeah, we got
some people
team.
Said, I'll throw $1,000 on that. If you win that bet, which is now very possible.
Now they're the highest, the lowest percentage to win, like the highest percentage to win. They're like 9-2 right now.
So if they win, they're like kind of odds on favorites to potentially win the Stanley Cup. If they do, those bets that people made at the beginning of the year, which seemed like nothing, I mean, it's not going to bankrupt Vegas, but it's going to put a dent in Vegas. Like, they could win the Stanley Cup and not be able to afford the parade. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Wait, who pays out the bet?
The casinos.
Casinos.
So in the book,
somehow
the bookmakers.
I think they'll be okay.
I think
they'll be okay, but they're going to take a huge hit if they win, which because the point was that people didn't think that they would be this far along this fast. Mm. So that bet is an easy bet to make at the beginning because you're like, well, it's my team now. Well, I'll throw some money on a long shot, and then boom, they are now sort of proving everybody wrong.
So they could actually win the cup.
They have a legitimate shot to potentially win it all. They're going to play the winner of Nashville-Winnipeg. And Nashville-Winnipeg, we thought Nashville was going to just kind of run through it. They've been a great team all year. But Winnipeg, you know, they're fighting them tough. It's going to go to a game seven. Who knows how much has been taken out of both teams in order to when they limp
into
the next
series. That's emotional. When you have a seven-game series, especially in hockey with how physical it is, you then take that sort of exhaustion into the next series. And the team that has a chance to rest usually has an advantage, at least coming into the first game. So, again, that bodes well for Las Vegas.
Which, who knows? Las Vegas could make it to the Stanley Cup in their very first year, which would be amazing.
Okay, finally, let's talk about how bad the Dodgers are.
Oops, well,
sorry, Mario.
Before we panic and hit the panic button on the Dodgers, a lot of people are hurt, namely Clayton Kershaw, Yasiel Puig. Guys are out.
But Clayton Kershaw is not having he's 1-4 this year. Let me just remind everybody listening, he lost 4 games total last year and the year before. Okay, so this is not a guy who loses a lot of games.
But he's out with tendonitis in his bicep, and, you know, some people are saying it's because he's throwing more curveballs this year. Some people are saying because that's the result of a decade of hard throwing. He's saying he's okay, and he's going to make changes and adjustments. They're saying he might be out for a few weeks.
He is a bit injury-prone, but I'll say this about him. What's crazy is his ERA is still below 3. It's like 2.87 or something like that now. So he's not getting the run support from this team, which last year was a powerful hitting team. You had a lot of guys on there that could hit the ball, and they were scoring a lot of runs, but this year they're just not. Guys are slumping. The whole league is slumping. Mm. I just read this, that this is the 6th worst batting average collectively for the whole league in the history of baseball.
Why is that?
It's at .244. Now, 300 is great. If you're hitting 300, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
But there are guys, I remember they would say 200 is the Mendoza line. There was a player named Mendoza. That was his career batting average. You go below the Mendoza line.
You're out.
You're out. That, or you're,
which I believe is the Mendoza line is where Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump were meeting at the Mendoza line. Is
yes.
that what we're talking about?
I think that is.
All right, fine. But the below the Mendoza line, there are a lot of players right now hitting like 157, 165.
Ooh, and they're still playing?
They're still playing. So because, and I think it's a change in philosophy in the way guys hit. There's a feeling now of like, I got to hit all or nothing. I got to hit a home run. If I don't hit the home run, they strike out. So you're seeing a lot of
averages are going down.
There have been 3 no-hitters pitched this year. One last night, James Paxton from the Seattle Mariners. He actually struck out 16 guys in the performance before that. He's a great left-handed pitcher. But the thing is, you're seeing no-hitters, one-hitters. Pitchers are dominating because I think players and batters are trying to swing for the fences. Mm. It's either all or nothing. And so you're seeing batting averages lower. Maybe you're seeing more home runs.
That's interesting.
But it's interesting.
All right. Speaking of pitching, why don't you pitch a little, KCRW?
Here's the pitch. You guys love this show. This is something that does a lot for you. This is your chance to give back.
I can't tell you how
show.
Many people we talk to who this show means so much to them as they're driving around, as they're commuting around, they're going to lunch and whatnot. There are people who say, I will, you know, I get into the parking garage and I have to listen to the show until I'll be late for a meeting because I have to listen to this in the end. If something stirs that much inside of you, I say support it. I support KCRW.
Support.
We contribute and we work here. So I'm saying because we love it and we listen to it, if we can do it, you guys can do it too. And if you want more great content like this,
yes,
just show your support. I feel like we need to be supporting great organizations like KCRW right now in this current climate just to show people that we care about quality.
In a sports analogy, hit a home run.
Yes.
Support KCRW.
Okay. Thanks, you guys.
You got
Thank
it.
You.
The Sklar Brothers, Randy and Jason, and check out their hilarious new audio documentary. It's called Sklars and Stripes. It's on Audible. Mm-hmm.